You are now tuned into CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Want to know more about the channel? Find us online at cjsf.ca.
Quick note that the following episode of Canada Land may contain subject matter and language that some people will find offensive.
The situation in Gaza is not morally acceptable. That's not a political declaration. It's just a basic truth. If innocence, if the innocence of children is something that exists, if human lives have value, if these are things that we believe and not like just sounds that we make with our mouths, if we can agree on that much, at least, then we must also agree that what we are watching unfold in Gaza every day in brutal clarity is not acceptable. And it's okay for everybody to agree on that. We can agree on that even if we can't agree on who is to blame for it or how to fix it. And if we do agree, if we can get to that minimum point of consensus, then maybe we here in Canada can actually do something about it. We can open our doors, as we have done before, for my people, maybe for yours, certainly not as much as we could or should have, but it is what we have done and it is what we can do now. We can bring people from Gaza here. Canada might not have the power to save the world, but we have saved worlds many times. Whoever saves a life, it is as though he has saved the lives of all men. That's how the Quran puts it. In the Talmud, it goes, whoever saves a single life is considered to have saved the whole world. So that is also something that we agree on. Today's show is about a man, a doctor, who is trying to save lives, save the worlds of his family, people who are in dire straits in Gaza. Canada Land reporter Cherise Souterin went to his home in Sherbrooke, Quebec, to hear his story.
We're about 2 hours outside of Montreal at a hospital in Sherbrooke, Quebec.
Hey.
Hello.
Hi.
You found us.
Finally, yes. Nice to meet you.
Nice
How are
to
you?
Meet you? I'm great. Thank you.
Dr. Ayman Ouida is leading audio editor Tristan and I through the entrance and down a quiet hallway.
Yeah, so we're in the Florimond Hospital in Sherbrooke, and we're going to the research center right now where my office is and my lab. So that's the research center.
We're not here to talk about science, but Tristan and I get distracted for a while checking out the instruments in the lab. It's not every day you get to see cancer research done up close. Ouida holds up a sample for us to examine. It's a sliver of mouse tissue stained purple and mounted onto a slide.
So this is a stained slide. This is an unstained slide.
Right.
We call it a blank slide. And the tissue here is a tumor.
Around the lab, there are the typical stuff you'd expect to see. Stacks of glass tubes, mysterious bottles of chemicals, and an assortment of microscopes. Then Tristan spots something odd.
Can I ask a question? What is that device on the end of the...
You can go
on the end there? Yeah. It
a
looks like...
Pressure cooker?
I was going to say, is it a pressure cooker?
Yeah, Are you cooking dinner?
It's actually your standard pressure cooker. I mean, look, it even says meat, rice, soup, bake, right?
So what do you use it for?
We got it from Amazon. So the tissue that we extract, you have to heat it at a very high temperature under a lot of pressure. And the pressure cooker is what does a really good job at that.
So you just, like, pressure cook it like a piece of meat?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I hate to say this, but it is a piece of meat, right?
We're all made out of meat.
We're all made out of meat, yeah. And
So, we're in his office now across the hall. It's decorated with degrees and diagrams of tumors. He says cancer presents a complex problem, where each attempt at improving treatment is met with resistance. It's why he got interested in the field. It was the idea that he could help to solve the seemingly impossible challenge.
It's just the complexity of the disease. It's such a complex disease, and it seems no matter how much we improve in the treatment of cancer, it always finds ways around overcoming these treatments and developing resistance. And so it just seemed to me like such a sophisticated question that I wanted to tackle some part of it and see if I could contribute to it in some way.
But there's another complex, seemingly impossible situation Ouida is trying to address. And it's the reason we came all the way to Sherbrooke to talk to him.
So the extended family is really big, but a lot of my memories are with my my cousins who are my age. I mean, I do have some who are younger and older. This was the last time when I was there.
He's talking about the last time he was in Gaza. Ouida has a Palestinian background and grew up visiting his family, over 30 aunts, cousins, uncles, nieces, and nephews. But now, they have all been displaced from their homes in Gaza. Some have been killed. Ouida has been trying to do what he can for them to help this whole situation from his home thousands of miles away in Sherbrooke. Fundraisers, media interviews, immigration applications. But it all seems to hit a wall.
Just the feeling of hopelessness and the fatigue with and somewhat of a depression also of seeing the news constantly day after day after day.
But now Ouida has joined a coalition of human rights lawyers as the only named individual in a letter to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. The letter states that Canada's military exports to Israel are a violation of our own laws and must cease. Just last week, The Maple reported that based on information from Global Affairs Canada, a record number of military exports to Israel had been authorized in the 2 months following the start of the war. That information was brought to Parliament.
The Liberal government has authorized $28.5 million of new military exports to Israel since October. How can the minister continue to sell arms to Israel?
The coalition's letter claims that there is a risk of Canadian exports being used in the violation of humanitarian law or in the commitment of serious acts of violence against women and children. This is where Ouida comes in. He believes he has proof of this in an eyewitness account from his aunt Fatima, who says she was the sole survivor of a targeted attack by the Israeli army. Ouida knows this attempt to do something might not result in change, but he says he has to try. After work, we meet Ouida back at his house, not far from the hospital.
Come on in.
Thank you.
Amazon.
It's a typical middle-class home, and we settle in on the living room couch while being inspected by one of his cats.
I see a nice cat.
Yeah, we have two cats. That's the more hyper one. We have a quieter.
His kids are home, two school-age boys, but they're feeling shy and they don't come out of the rooms. On the TV, a news station is playing scenes from Gaza. But on his phone, he shows us pictures of what life was like before, when he would visit the city of Zeytun, where his extended family lived.
I mean, when I'm in Gaza, it's the time to get away from my parents. It's the time to run away from them and go with my cousins who know the city really well and who can take me to places that, you know, our age would enjoy. We also enjoyed ice cream. There's a really, really popular ice cream place there.
What kind of ice cream is it?
You know, it's kind of like a gelato, some kind of a gelato ice cream. But this was like 20 years ago, and it was really, really good and authentic.
Ouida shows us some pictures from his childhood visits. In one, a group of older aunts sits in the living room, while young Ouida and his cousin make goofy faces through the window. In another photo, he's with more cousins and his grandmother, this time as a skinny teenager wearing a scowl.
And then this is my grandma, who now passed away, but that's me right there. And three cousins.
Teenage you?
Yeah, teenage me, and then three cousins. And then this one.
You've got like a little, like a cool guy.
Yeah, I was trying to be
cool.
I was
yeah.
So this cousin right here, he was one of my closest cousins. Mm-hmm. He's the one who I'm in contact with quite often.
Mm-hmm. We're just talking about his cousin Mahmoud. He's in the picture on the far left in a backward baseball cap. He looks to be about 14 years old. It's been years since he saw Mahmoud, but they still talk every day, at least on the days when Mahmoud can get internet access. In the mornings, around 9 a.m., it's 4 p.m. Gaza time, and Awida can usually expect a call or a text, sometimes photos or videos. He's watching the war unfold from his phone in real time.
I've been lucky to be able to stay in contact with him quite regularly, except when the towers are just completely out of fuel and there's no signal. But this is a piece of land across from where the school, he's staying in a Norwood school right now, along with my aunt, his four brothers. And so
the headlines over the past few weeks show that thousands of people have been moving to the south of Gaza in search of safety. Awida's family is part of that movement. They left their home in central Gaza to go to Khan Yunis, where they are currently sheltering at a school with thousands of others. On the phone with Mahmoud, Awida says he can hear sounds of shelling in the background.
There are schools that have been bombed, and in other cases where the debris would from nearby bombing would destroy the windows of a school or something, but that's the school where they're staying. And because of rain and heavy winds, they would have to like create these makeshift shelters to block the rain from...
He shows us a video. It's a windy day, and we're looking at the outside of a white and blue school where there's crowds and plastic tarps flying around everywhere.
Because the school space is not sufficient for everyone.
Yeah.
And it's primarily the women and the children who will stay inside the classrooms of a school. And that in itself will be crowded. But then the men, they let them go outside and find their own spaces.
Right.
But, I mean, look what happens outside. Yeah. These makeshift shelters, the tarps are now flying off because of heavy winds and rain. And then they do it all over again.
And so all of the tarps are kind of flying out and becoming destroyed with the wind.
And that's a bombing that took place near the school where they're living. And so he just took a picture and telling me, pray for us. It looks like it's getting really close.
He then plays a video for us of his 7-year-old niece, Nema. She's Mahmoud's daughter. She's in what looks like a crowded shelter, and she's holding an apple.
She was really sad here. She's like, I want to go home. I'm tired of this, in Arabic. But yeah, she gets disappointed at how long it's been taken. This is the first time she's had an apple in a really long time. And that we've been able to make that happen because of the funds that we're able to transfer. I mean, the food that they distribute is just in small amounts, and it's not nutritious. It's like soups and stuff like that. But she was happy to have an apple, which now she's going to share with five other kids, her cousins.
The money he's talking about, it's one of his attempts to help. By sending money to his cousins every month, it helps them afford food and other necessities, most of which are now only available for high fees on the black market.
I started sending more money to allow them to buy food, which is available sometimes in black markets. They sell it at very overpriced, like an apple would cost $3. And those are people who generally don't afford these kinds of prices. And so it became a lifeline. I think without this, you know, they would be in a much worse situation.
How much do you say, like, per month?
The first time I sent 2,000, second time another 2,000, and then eventually I couldn't afford to do it as much as I would like to. Mm-hmm. And that's when I had to do a GoFundMe page. I've never done this. I never thought I would do this one day, but I felt that it's so necessary.
But getting the money to family is another challenge. Awida is able to send it through Western Union, but the only Western Union in Gaza is in Rafah, a neighboring city. So he tells me that Mahmoud travels by taxi, up to an hour sometimes, and then stands in line with hundreds of others to get that money. But it's something. Awida's also tried another avenue to get his family help, going the immigration route to bring two of his uncles over to Canada.
There was a lot of requirements for documents, while knowing that this is a time in which almost the entire population of Gaza has been displaced. A lot of them don't have documentation. A lot of them, their homes are gone. But yeah, it was quite difficult. We were able to submit that application, and we know nothing about it until now. It's been 3-4 weeks almost. And we try to follow up, and the answer is always in progress. We're still working on it.
In January, the Canadian government launched its special temporary visa program for extended family members of Palestinian Canadians in Gaza. However, it has been criticized by immigration experts for requiring extensive documentation and being capped at 1,000.
And I think the Canadian government did not do the right thing in this policy by, you know, putting so many restrictions and conditions upon who can bring their loved ones.
Are you hopeful that this will be successful for them?
I don't know. At the beginning, I was hopeful. When the program first came out, I was hopeful. It took a long time for Canada to actually roll out a program like this, and it shouldn't have. But now, the longer we wait, the more we lose hope.
Mm-hmm. Then there's the matter of leaving Gaza through the Egyptian border, a costly and risky journey where success is not guaranteed.
If you get approval, you'd then have to leave. What is that process like?
Oof, that process? It's a nightmare. First of all, there are many people who want to do this and who are trying to do this. And second of all, there are people who want to take advantage of people who are trying to do this because they're so desperate. My cousin is actually one of those people who tried to do this, and he lost $10,000 just like that. I mean, this is like, you know, money, you know, that they earned in a hard way. But yeah, he couldn't get out, and the person just took the money and never came back.
While we're talking, Oita's friend Omar comes over. The two met a couple of years ago when Omar came to Canada on a graduate student visa in the biomedical sciences. They both happened to do research through the same university.
So I am Omar El-Jubiri. So I work in a research laboratory in the same department where Professor Weda is.
And in Sherbrooke, another Palestinian is hard not to notice. According to Oita, there are just 4 Palestinian families in all of Sherbrooke.
Yeah, I told her we doubled in number since you came, you know. We went up 2 times. I was actually really happy and excited when he came because we started with 1 family and then we doubled, me and him, and then we doubled again now. And you just feel so close, you know, he's family to me. And
Al-Jabri sees Oita's photos and shows us his own. Being in Canada on a student visa, his plan was always to return to Gaza with his degree and maybe teach at a university. He'd built his whole life there, quite literally, built it from the ground up.
Well, that was an apartment that I built rock by rock.
You built with your hands?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I built it, you know. I spent lots of resources and money to build. I economized for 4 years to be able to do it.
He's showing us pictures of the apartment building he helped to build. It's a modest building, about 3 floors high.
In that building, we used to live me and my uncle's family. And then they got all older and they were, you know, married and they needed, you know, their own apartments. So,
but then he switches to a different photo, this one of a bombed out structure amidst a pile of rubble. Al-Jabri says he didn't even recognize the building as his own apartment until his cousin, who sent the photo, had to literally spell it out for him.
Well, I will tell you something. Maybe you will laugh if I tell you that. But literally, when I looked at this image, I was not sure which one is my apartment because I didn't recognize it. Let me show you. He sent me that.
Wow.
He sent me telling me that this is your apartment.
So it's like an image that he's taking the same image, but he's like written over with names so he can tell.
With names, telling me that this is Ibrahim's flat. This is your uncle's flat. This is your flat.
Now, his plans to go back to live in that apartment with his wife and children and teach at a university are all over. That university was also bombed. Al-Jabri doesn't know what life will be like when he goes back, if that's even possible. Oita's family are also worried. Leaving Gaza seems impossible, but staying in one place also impossible and dangerous. And that leads to the crux of Oita's fears. Because more than the harrowing living situation and bombed buildings is the risk of death. Because he says some of his family members, civilians, were targeted and killed by the Israeli army, an example of the coalition's claims that Canada's exports of arms are used to violate human rights. According to Awida's aunt Fatima, she was taking refuge in an uncle's house with three other family members when bulldozers pulled up to the property and an IDF soldier entered the home.
So she was displaced from her home along with her two sisters who were living there. And they went to a relative's home that they thought was safe based on what Israel told them. It was just three sisters and one of their nieces. And so those three sisters would be my father's cousins, and the niece would be one of their daughters.
In a video from Al Jazeera posted online, Awida's Aunt Fatima gives her full witness account. Canadaland has not independently confirmed the account, but other media organizations have reported similar accounts of civilians being targeted by IDF soldiers. This video has been cut for length and translated and voiced by Canadaland producer Nora Azria.
He entered. My sister was standing behind the door, and she was holding a white sheet. And my daughter was also holding a white sheet, and telling him, yesh nashim, meaning that there are women here. He didn't care. He pushed the door and started shooting. The bullet hit her chin here. And for me, the bullet hit me here. I'll show you my hand. Here, a bullet grazed me and flew away. It was bleeding at first. But we heard him say, there are four mattresses here, but I only saw three women. I was behind my sister and he didn't see me. Then another man came and told him to come and started counting. He said to him, one, two, three. Then he stopped and told him, there is the fourth, referring to me. I was pretending to be lying down, but I was hearing everything. He stood there for about 20 seconds, staring at me. But those 20 seconds felt like 20 hours or 20 years because of how deeply I was feeling the fear. They took him out and left and closed the door of the room as the four of us were dead. I said, my sisters, who among you is awake? Oh, mama, princess, are you awake? Please, anyone answer me. Nobody answered me.
There's no reason that would justify this. These are not even fighters. These are actually civilians. These are hopeless old women in their 70s. And so three were killed and one stayed alive. And she's the one who lived to tell this story.
IDF spokespeople have maintained they are not purposely targeting civilians in Gaza. On the other side of the world, it was this video and this story that led Awida to be connected to a group of lawyers who believed it presented compelling evidence that Israel was targeting civilians and therefore committing violations of human rights.
I told them in one of our meetings about my story, and I said it seems to fit the criteria that you just spoke about in the sense that it was not an aerial bombing and it was a direct targeting by soldiers towards civilians. They were just women or in their 70s. I mean, what wrong could they have been doing?
The targeting of civilians has been a big part of the argument that South Africa is presenting at the ICJ in their genocide case against Israel. This is Adila Hassim, member of the legal team for South Africa, presenting the case in January.
This intent is evident from Israel's conduct in specially targeting Palestinians living in Gaza, using weaponry that causes large-scale homicidal destruction, as well as targeted sniping of civilians, designating safe zones for Palestinians to seek refuge, and then bombing these.
The coalition that Awida signed on to which included Canadian Lawyers for International Human Rights, also known as CLARE, and a Palestinian law group called Al-Haq, sent a letter in January to the Canadian government arguing that they must meet their obligations or face potential legal action. They gave them 2 weeks to respond. This is Henry Off, a lawyer with CLARE.
So the 2 weeks are up that we provided to Minister Joly in responding to this letter. We are now considering our legal options. One of those options would include a lawsuit against the federal government for the approval of export and brokering permits of military goods and items to Israel.
But the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Melanie Joly, has maintained that the current export of goods falls under Canadian law. This is her responding to questions about exports in Parliament.
When we look at the permits to Israel in particular, let me be clear. I have not received and therefore have not approved any export permits of weapons to Israel since October 7, and any permits issued since October 7 were essentially non-lethal permits. We abide by the UN Arms Trade Treaty, and we take this responsibility very seriously. Thank you.
The crux of this matter is the distinction between lethal and non-lethal goods. Because in Canada's defense industry, companies legally export military goods all over the world. These exports don't necessarily mean weapons. They can be protective gear or technology, but also parts for weapons, which all can be categorized as a non-lethal good, for which there isn't a clear definition. In the access to information documents obtained by the Maple, exports to Israel in the first 2 months of the war include goods under export categories, which include explosive devices and their components and aircraft equipment and their components.
The export of goods and categories related to these things, or related to military aircrafts and explosives and ground vehicles, raises the likelihood that Canadian military items and technology are being used to commit or facilitate these violations of international law in Gaza and the West Bank.
And then there are the concerns by human rights groups about Canada's indirect exports. A study by Project Plowshares found that Canada has exported parts for F-35 fighter jets to the U.S., which has contracts to export those jets to Israel. However, these types of exports aren't well documented. There is mounting pressure from human rights groups and the public for countries to examine the impact of their weapons exports. Just last week in the Netherlands, a court ruled in favor of an argument that supplying parts of weapons to Israel was a contribution to potential international law violations.
The ruling requires the Netherlands to cease the export and transit of any parts destined for Israel within 7 days. The parts are American-owned, but they're stored in a Dutch warehouse and then exported onto several partners.
And perhaps it's that pressure from groups like the one OIDA is part of that led to a motion being presented at the Committee on Foreign Affairs to study all documents related to arms exports to Israel for the past 4 years. NDP MP Heather McPherson presented the motion.
I have been asking for clear answers on military exports to Israel for a long time. I have not been able to get any accurate answers. I have received more than 250,000 emails into my inbox on this issue.
And that motion was passed. But in his living room in Sherbrooke, Quebec, OIDA admits he knows this is a long shot. He says the waiting, the hoping, the losing hope has all been exhausting.
There is a feeling of hopelessness because no matter what, how much I do, you know, there is this feeling that it's not giving results on the ground. I want to do something that can actually change something over there. And despite how much effort we collectively put together as people who advocate for human rights and peace and so on, it feels like Canada is not listening. As a Canadian citizen, I'm not afraid to ask for this, and I think Canada should value, if anything, should value people who want to establish justice and promote human rights and prosecute those who overstep their boundaries.
But yet he continues to try to solve this complex problem that may not have a real solution. But he'll try anything.
Sometimes you feel like you just want to isolate yourself and withdraw. But I think that that's the wrong thing to do. I think we can't give up.